Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. Poet, musician, and artist Patti Smith is at Penn State to receive the 2013 Institute of Arts and Humanities Medal for Distinguished Achievement. She joins us in our studio just a few hours before the evening celebration and her much-anticipated performance to talk with us about her life, art, and friendships. Patti Smith, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Poet, singer, artist, you are all three of those things, and obviously much more. But is there a hierarchy in your mind? Is one more important than the other?
Well, I would say the one that has been most consistent in my life is writing. Of all my vocations, naturally, mother presides over all of them. But I think in terms of my self-identification and the discipline I've spent most of my life pursuing is writing.
I immersed myself in, re-immersed, I guess I should say, in your work in the last couple of days. I read your book, Just Kids. I watched the POV documentary, Patti Smith, Dream of Life. Listened to your 2012 album, Banga, and of course your old tunes, Because the Night.
And
I have to say I came away thinking Patti Smith, authentic, fiercely energetic, courageous, loyal, warm, empathetic. And I'm wondering, how would you describe yourself?
Bad housekeeper. But sorry, just joking. Well, I think that, you know, I think I'm a good worker. I like to work. I work every day on one discipline or another. I write almost every day of my life. I have a lot of flaws, but I think that I have a good work ethic, which I really got from my father and mother. My siblings have it. We all have a good work ethic.
You talk about this in your memoir, Just Kids, that it has never been about fame and fortune, but it is about creating that masterpiece.
Yes, it's that elusive masterpiece. Well, it's the thing that motivates me and the thing that gives meaning in my life. I couldn't have a meaning-centered life based on fame or fortune, both which are exciting but fleeting. It's really for me, other than hopefully being a good mother, is doing good work. My life has been enriched by the work of others, from Pinocchio to Moby Dick to the next Murakami book, you know. So I always wanted to add to that canon.
And that brings me back to your parents. You grew up in rural South Jersey.
Yes.
Spent some time in Philadelphia before that. Your mother was a waitress. Your father worked in a factory. And your parents seemed remarkable in so many ways. One, because of the kinds of things they gave you. Your mother gave you William Blake to read when you were just a young child. Your father talked with you about important things and was well-read and encouraged that in you.
Yes, well, neither my mother or father finished high school. They had a good upbringing. They were both well-read, and they read throughout their whole lives. And we were we were a communication-based family. We'd sit around the table. We'd talk about things. My father was very open-minded, so we could come to him if we had conventionally difficult problems. You know, if we had an interracial relationship or whatever it might be, if sexuality was a question, ideas about religion or flying saucers. And my mother was very community-based. She wasn't a political activist, but she was always helping her neighbors. As difficult times we had, she always managed to find someone in the neighborhood who was having a more difficult time. If we were hungrier, she always managed to find kids that were hungrier. She was a great storyteller. And
she attended your concerts into her 80s.
Oh, yes. Till shortly before she died, she loved rock and roll, and she was very supportive. My parents were free thinkers, but they had strong moral codes, and as I said, had strong work ethics. So I learned good things from them.
You were actually raised Jehovah's Witness, and your father, you say, was agnostic. And so your spiritual or religious background in a lot of ways is kind of unconventional, but I've rarely seen you, maybe today, where you're not wearing a cross.
I have it in my pocket.
Okay.
I have a rash on my neck, so I actually have, I might have it in this pocket. I have my St. Francis cross with me. It might be in my
What does that mean to you?
The St. Francis cross was given to me from the monks of Assisi because they had me for lunch one day because I was in Italy, and they liked a song that I had written for St. Francis, and I met with them, and they gave me a towel, you know, a St. Francis cross.
I dreamed a dream of St. Francis who kneeled and prayed for the birds and
I like the cross. It's a beautiful, you know, that to me symbolizes sacrifice. But really, when I was a Jehovah's Witness, they don't have any kind of symbols such as that. They don't have any icons or statues or art. It's a completely scriptural-based religion. So I really got a tremendous Bible education by the time I left. But I really decided by the time I was 13 that I didn't want to be in an organized religion, that I wanted to have my own relationship with God, and I wanted to interpret the scriptures in my own way.
And you've had to sort of explain for years a famous line in one of your songs that Jesus didn't die for you.
Yes. Well, he didn't die for my sins. I wrote that when I was 20 years old, actually long before I recorded it. And I wrote it directly to respond to the idea that it was a declaration of existence. I wanted to take responsibility for experimentation or for the things that I wanted to try. I didn't want to live by a set of preconceived rules. And at the end, as I evolved, I realized that my fight or my rebellion wasn't against Jesus Christ. It was more against organized religion. Because I have great respect for Jesus Christ. He was a tremendous example. He was a revolutionary. He gave us the most beautiful of all commandments to love one another. And so I have great feelings for him.
Speaking of great feelings, your book, Just Kids, is about your remarkable relationship with Robert Mapplethorpe. I read the book on my way. In fact, I read the book out loud to my husband on the way to and from vacation. actually, he kept waiting for us to get back in the car so we could hear the rest of it. And I had a hard time when it was over. I wanted it to continue. I'm wondering what it was like for you to write it.
It was very difficult. I probably wouldn't have written it except Robert the day before he died, when he still could talk because he lost power of speech. He asked me to write our story, and I knew exactly what he meant because when we were quite young, from our very first meeting, Robert loved how we met. It was very magical. And when we had nowhere to go, we had no money. Sometimes when we had no food, we were a little hungry, he'd say, "Tell me our story." And I had to start from the beginning and get to where we were at that moment. And sometimes he would often fall asleep. But I knew this story almost by heart. And so I knew the story he wanted me to write. But it was very difficult. It was painful. And then a few years after he asked me to write it, and I was still outlining it, my husband died, and then my brother. And to return to a book about another person that I had lost was too difficult. So I did shelve it for a while, and it took me a long time. And I had never written an extended piece of nonfiction, and I did it myself. I didn't have a specific editor or anything. But I finally did. I finished it, and I'm very glad. But I don't think another book would ever be as painful and lengthy. I had to really learn how to write a book, an extended piece of nonfiction in the writing of it.
You write about meeting Robert Mapplethorpe. You arrive in New York City. You are literally sleeping on the streets. You get a job in a bookstore, despite the fact that you're still living on the streets. And he's one of the first people you meet. And later he comes into the bookstore, and he falls in love with a necklace that you also really loved. But the second meeting, he rescues you from a very bad date, a date that
That was our third meeting.
Okay.
The first meeting I had, he was sleeping. And he woke up and helped me find an address. He was a stranger. The second time he came into the bookstore, I was working in the jewelry department of the bookstore, and I had fallen in love with a small Persian necklace, which was very obscure. Most of the other jewelry was big, opulent, and expensive. And I had dreams of saving up to buy it. And then he came in and bought it. And I couldn't believe that this boy that I had only met once came in and picked the exact same thing that I'd love. And the third time I was in a bit of trouble. He did rescue me. All of that happened in late July, August. By September 1st, he gave me the necklace, and we became inseparable.
You're here, as I said, to receive Penn State's 2013 Institute of Arts and Humanities Medal for Distinguished Achievement. And it's not the Spartan of the Year, which was a coveted award that you won in high school. It's not an induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, which happened for you in 2007. But I'm wondering, is it an important validation nonetheless of how far you've come and what you've achieved?
Certainly. Any time that... I have never expected to have honors in my life. When I chose to be a writer, to be an artist, I understood even at a very young age that it meant sacrifice and perhaps a lack of recognition in one's lifetime. And so whenever I receive it, I'm always surprised and humbled and really happy. I never expected to be Spartan of the Year. And I have to say, no other award that I've ever gotten, however grand or important, nothing can really compare to that first validation. I never expected it. I still don't understand why I got it, because it was a very coveted award in my high school. It meant that, you know, it validated everything that you you did, and I wasn't an exceptional student. You know, I was just so happy, and it has followed me through my whole life. It gave me an extra bit of armor. And so every time I receive something of this nature, I receive the Katharine Hepburn Award. I've received, you know, a Commandeur Award from the French Republic. And to receive this tonight, it's like another piece of armor that makes me feel like I can go out into the world. I have that much more moral courage. Makes me happy. I mean, I don't work to receive honors, but when I get them, I think it's very important when people honor you to embrace the honor or to not accept it. Because if you're accepting it, you're accepting the belief of a lot of people, and that's a beautiful thing.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patti Satalia with the multifaceted poet, artist, and rock musician Patti Smith. She's on the campus of Penn State to accept the Institute of Arts and Humanities 2013 Medal for Distinguished Achievement. The first time you stood in front of an audience, in front of a microphone, to read poetry out loud, you're in a bar in New York City in 1971. They were expecting to hear a rock band, and you start reciting poetry. And it took tremendous courage to do that. You write about hecklers who were saying, sit down.
You know, I don't think of it as courage. I don't get stage fright. I've always liked talking in front of people. When I was in high school, I loved giving oral book reports. I loved getting in front of the class and talking about Moby Dick or Holden Caulfield. And one can't forget, I was a Jehovah's Witness. I spent every Saturday for years going door to door to talk to people, to show concern for their well-being or to speak to them. And I've just always liked speaking before people. I don't think it took courage at all. I think maybe a little bit of guts. Because, first of all, the first time I did that at a bar, I didn't have a microphone. I didn't.
So you just scream above the din.
Yell my poems. And I just thought of myself in the school of Johnny Carson. When people heckled me, I just threw it right back to them. Because Johnny Carson, you know, I've said this before, but he was like a human parachute. He could bail out of any situation. And I used to watch him with my father. The first time I was heckled, I thought, oh, great, I get to, like, you know, throw him a Johnny Carson one-liner. And by the end, I usually got the people on my side.
What scares you today, if anything?
Well, I'm a mother, so my only fear, really my greatest fear in life, is that any harm or ill health would come to my children. And that I extend to my concerns about our environment, our concerns about the amount of violence in our culture, how cancer is so heavily on the rise in our world. But I don't live in fear. It's just, I mean, I basically try to be positive forward. You know, I'm not saying I'm fearless. It's just that I don't let fear be my deciding factor as I proceed in life. And, you know, I try to be prudent, but not frightened.
Your kids have worked with you. Jackson is a guitarist. Jessie, your daughter, is an accomplished pianist making a name for herself in the music scene in Detroit. How different was their introduction into music than yours? And I guess what I'm really talking about is that in a way it seems as though you decided when you saw Jim Morrison, for example, on stage, that you could do that, that you didn't have any formal training.
Well, the difference between, first of all, they haven't either, but I'm not a musician. I'm a performer. I really can't play any instrument with any proficiency. I can play a few chords on an acoustic guitar.
You play the clarinet?
Yeah, but again, self-taught a little. I can improvise a little. But my son and daughter are actual born musicians. Their father was a musician. They're accomplished. Self-taught, but with great diligence. You know, my son practiced from 5 to 13 hours a day when he was learning guitar. He has moved from guitar to mandolin to pedal steel. He can play anything. My daughter composes. They are true musicians. So I couldn't compare myself to them at all because I'm not a musician. I don't think like one. I don't have their proficiency. You know, my son and daughter, you know, have had different challenges in their life. My challenges, you know, I wanted to be an artist. I struck out and went to New York City. I didn't strike out to be a singer. When I saw Jim Morrison, I wasn't thinking I could sing like him or write like him. I just felt seeing him on stage, I had no fear of that. I was
amazing.
Watching him, and I felt like, I don't know why I thought that. Believe me, I had no sense of future or fate. I didn't want to be Jim Morrison. I just had this strange sense that I could do that. Well, in the end, it turned out I do have a certain ability to go on stage and front a rock and roll band. But it wasn't my motivating factor in life. And what has motivated my son and daughter is, you know, they've had different trials.
You know, was it a trial at all that they were the offspring of Patti Smith and Fred Sonic Smith?
I don't know. You'd have to ask them. I mean, their trial was that they lost their father at 12 and 6 years old, a much greater trial than being fettered with rock star parents. And they had to negotiate life without their father. So I've had many trials in my life, but nothing to compare with that. So, you know, we all have our trials.
You came to creative life in New York City in the late 1960s and in early 70s, and you moved with your two young children back there a couple of years after your husband died.
Yes.
What was that New York like compared to the one you left?
Very different. It was a bit of culture shock. I brought them because I stayed in Detroit after he died, but I don't drive, so... it was very, very challenging to try to raise two children in the Motor City where everyone drives, where there's no real defined public transportation. So I came back to New York. Really, it's a pedestrian city. I knew it well, and I could get work there so I could make a living. But the city had vastly changed. It had changed in its look. It was quite built up, much more expensive, very expensive. And then other things that seem subtle and small but were big to me. I remember Michael Stipe. I had met Michael Stipe, and he took me to a restaurant.
Michael Stipe of REM.
Yes. It was late at night, and we felt like having breakfast late at night, steak and eggs at midnight. And we were sitting there, and I heard this loud, horrendous, thumping tone, and I didn't know what it was. I said, "What is that sound?" And he said, "Which sound?" And I said, "That sound. It's going boom, boom." And I pointed it out, and he said, "Oh, it's the bass line of the song that's on." I said, "That's terrible. You know, isn't that bothering people?" You know, he laughed and we talked about it. I had never heard such a thing because in the 70s, I left New York in 79. They didn't even play music in restaurants, maybe a little Miles Davis or something, or sometimes they had jukeboxes and you just played music at your table. But there was no overhead music unless you went to a disco or something, but not in a restaurant where you're getting eggs or not in a clothing store. There had been a cultural shift. Also, people were starting to use computers, which I hadn't, you know, really seen or used yet. And then cell phones, which I hadn't really been exposed to. So, well, I had to negotiate the change in the city, but the change in our culture, because I had lived a very simple life with Fred. I'm not saying we lived in the Ozarks, but we did live very simply. You know, we had a TV set, we had a record player, and we were still playing records, you know, and I had to get back in step. And it was really my son and daughter who taught me how to use our present technology. I resisted it.
You shun some of it still. I mean, you're still using a vintage Polaroid Land camera, for example, for your photography work.
Well, I do that by choice. You know, I do that by choice. I'm not really interested in being a photographer. I like taking Polaroid pictures. I have used a 35 millimeter in the 60s and 70s, but I'm not very technically proficient, and I just don't have a lot of interest in it. I understand its merits and even its political possibilities, but I make use of it the way I need. I mean, I don't have Twitter or Facebook or any of that stuff, but it's not even a judgment. I just don't have time.
You mentioned Michael Stipe of REM just a moment ago, and he ranked one of your live performances among his top 10 life experiences.
So nice.
And he's not alone because the August issue of Rolling Stone, you were named one of the 50 greatest live acts to see now. That must feel incredible at 66.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm happy, but I have to say if I felt that I couldn't do a really good job, especially now in our present climate, especially because so many young people come to see our band, I would step away. I'm still performing because I'm still a strong performer. Whether or not I'm in the top 50, I don't know. But
I think you ranked 22nd or 23rd, according to Rolling Stone.
But we do a good job. We're a very simple band. We don't have any real technology. I mean, we're a rock band. We have the same amps. We have pretty much
the same performers. Lenny Kaye is out in the studio.
And if Richard Soul was alive, he would still be
your
playing
pianist.
With us. And my drummer is still with us. My bass player has been with me for 15 years. So we're a very strong, organic rock band. We don't have lighting cues. I don't even have a lighting guy. We don't have sound cues. I often change the set list midstream in a night. If people keep asking for a certain song, we'll sing it or try to sing it. We're there for the people. We're not there to give them a Broadway show. We're there to have a night together.
So staying true to where you came from sounds like it's like breathing.
Well, it's just what I do. I mean, it's not like I have special integrity or anything. It's just that's how I operate. I don't have any, you know, if I was going to do something really structured, I'd go into the theater, you know. And I don't think, you know, for me, rock and roll isn't theater. It's, you know, it's an energy exchange.
You were actually in a number of plays when you lived in New York the first time and have said, I'm not an actress. That's one of the things you discovered, despite the fact that you were frequently cast in plays. You wrote a couple of plays and you were cast in some, sometimes for reasons that struck you as a bit mysterious.
I actually even had opportunities to be off Broadway and to be in very good roles. But being an actor depends on very selfless discipline. You have to defer to blocking, lighting, a script, a director, to be very prudent and compassionate towards your fellow actors, make certain that you don't do something that throws them off, and it's repetitious. I don't like wearing makeup. There's a lot of makeup and costumes, and I just knew it wasn't my world, but I really did like being on stage. I enjoyed being in plays because I liked getting reactions from people, especially laughter. But I knew that acting wasn't right for me. And it wasn't long after I just decided to quit acting that I started performing poetry and then singing on stage. And so that same interest in communicating with the people from the stage was invested in rock and roll.
What do you see as your responsibility as an artist?
Well, my responsibility as an artist is to do the best work I can. As a human being, my responsibility is to my fellow man. I don't think as an artist my responsibility is to my fellow man. My responsibility as an artist is to hopefully contribute to the canon of art something fine that hopefully will resonate with the people. If I could write something as great as Pinocchio, I would. If I could write a song like, you know, Rolling in the Deep, like, you know, Adele sang, I would. You know, a lot of my work tends to be obscure, except for this little book, Just Kids, which the people have happily embraced. But my responsibility is to be true to my work. As a human being, my responsibility is to be a good mother, is to recycle, is to try to be prudent, is to vote, is to speak out against social injustice. But as an artist, it's for me, it's to do good work.
And on that note, we are out of time. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
That was poet and rock legend Patti Smith. She's at Penn State to receive the Institute for Arts and Humanities 2013 Medal for Distinguished Achievement. To hear more of this interview or to read an excerpt from her 2010 memoir, Just Kids, check the links at our website, wpsu.org/take note. I'm Patti Satalia, WPSU.